This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to www.bbc.co.uk/radio3.
The Bayeux Tapestry was probably not considered a treasure in its own time, when gold was valued above all. Textiles were no exception. The English were adept at embroidering expensive silk, covering it all over with tiny stitches in fine silks and spun gold. The Bayeux Tapestry, in contrast, is embroidered in thick, brightly coloured wools on a creamy linen base that is left bare between blocks of stitching. It consists of 9 lengths of cloth, unobtrusively joined together to make a continuous frieze. It is an enormous length, measuring over 68 metres, even today when both ends are missing. It must have been intended to hang in an unusually grand room, and therefore owned by one of the new Anglo-Norman elite. That could have been King William the Conqueror himself, but our best guess at present is that it was made for Odo, Bishop of Bayeux, the king's half-brother. Because Odo is depicted several times in the tapestry, advising his brother and rallying the troops heroically at the Battle of Hastings. Odo was imprisoned in 1082 and banished from England in 1088, when the tapestry may have accompanied him back to Bayeux. A lot of the scholarship on the Bayeux Tapestry has focused on its value as a historical document, but consideration of how this enormous artwork was made requires thinking about many processes. All the materials were, of course, prepared by hand. Linen cloth took months to produce, from the sowing of flaxseed through the weeding and harvesting of the crop. Then the flax was rippled or combed to remove seed heads. The woody stalks were retted in water to soften the outer bark and loosen the inner fibres. This unpleasant, smelly process could take about 3 weeks. The stems were then dried and beaten and scutched to remove the long flax fibres. These were combed through iron spikes to get rid of woody bits and produce the fine fibre suitable for spinning. Most of these hard physical jobs were women's work. Spinning, too, was traditionally a female occupation. Fibres were twisted with fingers and thumb and drawn out by means of a drop spindle attached to a rotating weight. Since flax fibres had to be kept moist, women were constantly wetting them with saliva. Medieval pictures show women carrying their distaff and spindle with them everywhere, even feeding the hens, since such a large quantity of spun thread was needed to feed the weaving process. We don't know if all spinning was domestic or if there were organised spinning workshops by the 11th century. The tapestry's long linen strips may have been woven on the new horizontal treadle loom, introduced about the year 1000, which was operated by men, revolutionising textile production in Western Europe. Weaving had traditionally been women's work before this. The embroidery thread is wool. Sheep were smaller and less fleecy than today, but there were plenty of them, since they provided meat, milk, cheese, parchment and horn, as well as wool. In making our embroidery thread, fleeces were washed and scoured to remove dirt, then dyed in 10 shades of red, yellow, beige, blue and green, all achieved with woad, madder and probably pastel plants. Chunks of fleece were then teased apart with the fingers, combed till the fibres lay parallel, then spun. Again, women's work. Colours seem to be uniform throughout the tapestry and are carefully worked out. It's fascinating to see that there are no two figures or horses exactly the same, and adjacent figures are never dressed in the same colours. This all suggests detailed advanced planning. The Bayeux Tapestry was almost certainly designed here in England and probably made here too. We can be confident about the design at least because many of its images are copied from illuminated manuscripts still in existence, which in the 11th century were housed in Canterbury in Kent. I suggest the designer was a male cleric, because such a person is most likely to have had access to those libraries. He mainly used illustrated biblical manuscripts, but also took pictures from Prudentius's allegorical poem Psychomachia and from other manuscripts. The master designer of the tapestry used these images to create a new story of Harold, brother-in-law of King Edward the Confessor, who fell into enemy hands and was rescued by William, Duke of Normandy. How Harold then campaigned heroically alongside William and was rewarded by him. How he swore an oath of allegiance to the Duke, perhaps unwillingly, but publicly. And how, on the death of King Edward, he reneged on that oath by taking the English crown for himself. And how William built a fleet, invaded England, and won the throne he believed was rightly his in the bloodbath that was the Battle of Hastings. The drawing may have been carried out by several different subcontractors. There are little distinctions, like the way faces are depicted. The borders may have been delegated to different designers and artists. They copied pictures from other manuscripts, including Aesop's Fables and probably an illustrated calendar, alongside the birds, beasts and fantasy creatures, which were traditional textile motifs. We don't know how or on what the design was drafted out. Paper didn't exist, and making a full-scale version on parchment would have been a very extravagant use of animal skins. There is no cartoon visible on the tapestry today. It may have faded or been washed out over the centuries. It could have been drawn with charcoal, or perhaps coloured inks, an idea I rather like, because that would have been a way of indicating to the embroiderers which colours they were to use. The graphics were probably designed geometrically, in square or rectangular blocks, though this gets abandoned in places, probably when it was discovered that the design was too short for the second wall. At that discovery, which must have caused dismay, the organisers may have brought in a new artist to create extra scenes. The top and bottom borders are not coordinated and often bear no spatial relationship to the main register. At times, though, a border artist evidently responds to the main register. A solitary wolf howls its grief under King Edward's funeral. Little border scenes may comment on events in the story. Some scholars suggest they provide a pro-English subtext to the pro-Norman narrative. My own personal opinion is that they suggest cynicism about the rich and powerful of both the Norman and the English factions. There is a succinct commentary which must have been written onto the cloth after the pictures, because the letters are fitted round figures, spears and buildings. The text seems to reflect a dialogue, spoken in Latin, between a Norman and an English person. I say this because some of the words are Latinized versions of French, and some spellings suggest French pronunciation. But the use of Old English letters shows that an English-trained scribe wrote it down. Perhaps the Norman was the spokesman for the eventual owner. The scribe was of the now subordinate English race. With images and text drawn onto the linen, the cloth was ready to embroider. Different teams may have taken different sections of linen and worked simultaneously. There was clearly a pre-agreed style. Stem stitch outlines depict human hands and faces, eyes, eyebrows and mouths, and sometimes moustaches and beards are indicated, but the rest of the skin is left blank. Stem stitch outlines and contours give shape to clothing, horses, trees, buildings and dogs, which are filled in with laid work, where coloured threads are laid parallel and couched down by transverse threads, which are themselves secured with tiny stitches lying across them. This technique fills space quickly and is economical, with the minimum of thread being wasted on the back where it won't be seen. By changing the direction of threads, the embroiderers suggest anatomical shape, the bend of an elbow, or the transition between an animal's limb and body. This is unique. We don't have any other early medieval hangings worked in this technique. The question remains, who embroidered the Bayeux tapestry? One tradition claimed it was Matilda, William's Duchess, and her Norman ladies, but this has lost favour in view of the compelling evidence of English design. If you read old books, some of them will say it was embroidered by nuns. Certainly, nuns would be able to sew, and some to embroider, but their skills are more likely to have been employed on ecclesiastical textiles than a secular narrative about a power struggle. A recent suggestion that has attracted a lot of attention is that the Bayeux tapestry could have been embroidered by the widowed Queen Edith and her circle. Edith was married to King Edward the Confessor and sister to Harold, who ruled briefly between Edward's death and William's conquest. Unlike the rest of her family, she did not go into exile at the conquest and seems to have retained the respect of King William. She remained living in Winchester and at Wilton Abbey, of which she was patron. There were many widows and orphans of the Battle of Hastings, both English and Norman, retired to convents, who might have welcomed some creative occupation, and the presentation of a flattering artwork to Odo, or to the king himself, might have ensured that they were left in peace and relative comfort. A possible composer of the narrative is Edith's chaplain Gosselin, but he is not known to have been at Canterbury until years later, after Edith was dead. There is a missing link here between the Canterbury inspiration of the design and the execution of the embroidery at Winchester or a West of England convent. Another problem is that great ladies would have been accustomed to working in silk and gold. Would such ladies have wanted to adapt to different embroidery techniques and to stitch commonplace wool and linen, rather harsh materials, with their soft aristocratic hands? Another possibility is that the Bayeux tapestry is entirely professional work. In support of this, the embroidery is consistent, neat, economical, and capable of being executed fast. We insult the Anglo-Saxons if we assume their needlework was an amateur hobby. Embroidery was a decorative art, like metalwork or manuscript illumination, and probably involved extensive training and organised production. It is generally assumed that the embroiderers were women, but later, in the 12th and 13th centuries, when English embroidery emerges as a highly desirable commodity fit for the garments of popes and monarchs, there were male as well as female embroiderers, the men, of course, being paid more than the women. Now, the typical Anglo-Saxon picture of a man is either that of a hero in battle or of a religious ascetic figure. A man doing embroidery would not fit the stereotype of that time. But there are so many things the Anglo-Saxons don't tell us about themselves. I suggest that rather than being the leisured pastime of courtly ladies or the occupation of nuns, the Bayeux tapestry was a professional product, commissioned for, or perhaps by, Bishop Odo. He wasn't known for his modesty. Made as quickly as possible by a team of efficient workers to justify the Normans' claim to the throne and to celebrate their victory while the memory was fresh. A vivid, portable testament to the beginning of a new Norman era.